Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What made Steve Jobs so remarkable? We think of him as the guy who famously figured out how to give us what we wanted from our technology before we even realized we wanted it. But his almost mythic reputation as a highly driven innovator can obscure the fact that Jobs also cultivated an astonishing gift for reinvention. Had he remained unchanged by his 1985 departure from Apple, he might have been resigned to relative obscurity as an early but ultimately overshadowed player in consumer electronics. Instead, Jobs started up another computer company, bought up the property that would become Pixar, returned to Apple as CEO in 1997, and was at the helm when Apple rolled out some of the most successful devices in history. And as my guest will tell us, all the while Jobs was reimagining products and imagining new ones, he was also directing the work of the people who brought them into existence and refining his approach to managing his company, his products, and his highly talented employees. Rick Tetzeli is executive editor of Fast Company magazine and co-author, along with Brent Schlender, of Becoming Steve Jobs, The Evolution of a Reckless Upstart into a Visionary Leader. Rick, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Why are there so many myths about Steve Jobs?
Well, I don't think there's another businessman who has so gotten into the lives of the average consumer. Apple is an extraordinary company. It behaves in unextraordinary ways as well. But it has again and again, as you pointed out in your introduction, given us things that we didn't know we wanted. And it's just created this personal relationship with a company that I don't really think has ever existed before. It's really extraordinary.
One thing that never changed about Steve Jobs was that whatever he was working on, he really cared about. How did that affect the way he worked with other people early in his career?
Well, this sort of gets to the heart of our book, actually, because the reason we got going on the book is my co-author, Brent Schlender, knew Steve for 25 years, covered him for Wall Street Journal and Fortune, and he saw enormous change over that time. Brent used to tell – I was Brent's editor at Fortune magazine, and he used to tell me that he'd never seen a businessman change as much as Steve Jobs changed. When he was a young man, he had incredible power of will. He was very charismatic. He was an incredible opportunist. And he came to computing from the outside. He was not an engineer per se. He was more of a liberal arts guy who got interested in computing. Those things all gave him an enormous advantage at the time when the industry was just coming out of the hobbyists' world, people who used to tinker around and try and create new things. So his job during the first 10 years of Apple was really to rally small groups of people and try to get them to do great things. And he succeeded once with the Macintosh, which was a brilliant concept, masterfully delivered, and woefully underpowered as a machine. It really didn't become a successful computer until Jobs was kicked out of the company. He also failed a couple of times, and he failed to lead groups of people. When he came back 12 years later in 1997, and, you know, as Bill Gates told us, the board of directors handed him the job of CEO and said, "Whoa, what have we done now?" he had really learned how to work with small groups of creative people. And in some ways, that is the key to the successful comeback of Apple.
You mentioned the fact that that Steve Jobs was charismatic, and that's something that sometimes tends to get lost. As much as American consumers would see those videos of him and his famous black turtleneck and the running shoes and the jeans, you know, the story was always that behind the scenes he was this tyrant. And yet lots of people who might have seen that side of him say, yes, but there was also this other part of Jobs that hasn't been effectively captured until now.
Right. For the, you know, originally Apple wasn't going to cooperate with us on the book. They had cooperated with Walter Isaacson's biography. That was, you know, it was a year after Steve's death when we started going. They'd had enough of books about Steve Jobs.
And excuse me for interrupting. That was the authorized biography that you're talking about.
That was the authorized biography. That was, you know, Steve chose Walter Isaacson as his biographer. Isaacson had done, you know, a few noteworthy biographies before that. I mean, he was a natural choice. And so we started out interviewing around the company. And Brent had covered the company for so long, he knew all the significant players. He knew where they were. He knew what they'd gone on to do. He knew how their relationships had ended with Steve. Many of them had ended quite badly. But for me, as something of an outsider, I only met Jobs twice while he was alive. It was amazing to see those early interviews and to see these people talk about him in the present tense, start crying when they spoke about him, start talking about how they felt that nothing had ever shown how charming he was. At the same time that they'd also say, you know, Steve often, almost always, had an ulterior agenda. He wanted to get something out of you. So, you know, there were these two sides of him, and Brent felt, and I began to feel as I got into it, that there was this sort of more humane side of the man that had gotten lost in all the stories of, you know, his outrageous behavior, which truly could be outrageous.
What went wrong with Next Computers?
Several things. although in the end it worked. In the end, the end of Next, the last 3 or 4 years of Next, Steve began to show a persistence that would serve him very well when he came back to Apple, and that was a quality he had not shown earlier in his life. He was interested in a project for a year or so, and then he had to move on. It was always about what's new. Anyway, he started Next and wanted basically to create another breakthrough computer. He wanted to replicate the success he'd enjoyed with the Mac. But he overlooked many things. He overlooked the fact that he did not know how to run a company. The company, Apple, had been run for him by other people. Steve was only CEO of Next for 2 months early on. He neglected to reckon with competition. When the Apple II came out, there was no personal computer industry really that he had to deal with. The Mac was unlike any machine that had been dreamed up to that time. By the time he started creating Next, and as it got later into the late 80s, there was a significant competitive world out there. IBM was strong. Sun was an incredibly successful, cheap workstation manufacturer, giving engineers what they wanted. And he missed missed the competitive landscape, and he missed his vision. And his vision was off. He failed to rally his troops. And fundamentally, he was in the wrong business and he didn't know it at that time. Steve Jobs created devices for people. And Bill Gates at that time and other people had mastered the art of creating computing for businesses. And Steve didn't understand that. He thought he could do anything, and he couldn't.
What's the most interesting thing Bill Gates told you about Steve Jobs?
Oh, Gates is wonderful. actually, you know, that was another wonderful thing for me in this project. Was Gates was actually the first interview we did for the project, and I'll never forget. At one point, we were sitting in his offices, and he stood up and started sort of nattering on and getting into constant motion, and he was doing a pantomime of Steve Jobs behind the scenes before a presentation, and he would say, and then I'd sit there and I'd watch him, and Steve would go out there and he'd put his hand to his forehead and he'd furrow his brow and he'd say, oh yeah, one more thing. And I'd be backstage and I'd realize I'd seen that three times already, that exact same move he was practicing. So the really interesting thing that Gates saw about Jobs was, and it was the beginning for me of really, really wrestling with this, was the complexity of what he had achieved. Gates really understood how complex the recovery was at Apple. And in fact, he said to us, you know, you should call your book Don't Try This at Home, because he said that's the level of complexity that he's pulled off. He also said to us, you know, he said, I talk to a lot of entrepreneurs these days, and a lot of them have the jerk side of the equation down. It's just the genius that they're missing.
The time that Jobs spent at Pixar seems to have been a real turning point for him. The culture at that company was really different from anything that he himself had created before as the manager of people or products.
At Pixar, he met his most important mentor, Ed Catmull, who runs that company. Catmull is one of the great managers in America, an extraordinary man. And he manages with a temperate, calm, steely manner that Steve never replicated. Steve was volatile. But the history, Pixar started about 20 years before Toy Story was made. And through that whole time, it had the most extraordinary collection of animators on the planet. And yet they failed and failed again as a business. They helped George Lucas with some of his computer animation. So what he learned at Pixar was how to manage creative people. How a leader who himself is creative and extremely intelligent can give other people the free rein to create brilliant things. And this is, you know, where there's this another misunderstanding about Jobs. He's often called a micromanager, but he was not in the way we traditionally think of him.
My guest is Fast Company executive editor Rick Tetzeli. He is co-author of the new book, Becoming Steve Jobs, The Evolution of a Reckless Upstart into a Visionary Leader. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies, offering evening programs for a Master of Liberal Studies and the new Doctor of Liberal Studies degree. You can design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU this fall. More at smu.edu/GLS.
talking about Macintosh recently, but today, for the first time ever, I'd like to let Macintosh speak for itself.
Hello, I am Macintosh. It sure is great to get out of that bag. And accustomed as I am to public speaking, I'd like to share with you a maxim I thought of the first time I met an IBM mainframe. Never trust a computer you can't with. Obviously, I can talk, but right now, I'd like to sit back and listen. So it is with considerable pride that I introduce a man who's been like a father to me, Steve Jobs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. You just heard a young Steve Jobs introducing the Macintosh computer for the first time to Apple shareholders in January 1984. We're speaking this hour with Fast Company editor and author, co-author of a new book, Becoming Steve Jobs, The Evolution of a Reckless Upstart into a Visionary Leader, Rick Tetzeli. You have to love the 80s, Rick, and the way that things were made to seem high-tech back then. It's interesting, you know, even in that clip, a man who's been like a father to me, Steve Jobs. Jobs, particularly in his second round at Apple, was fully aware that the success of the company was a collaborative effort. Is there a reason why in the public imagination it was like people imagined Jobs doing all the work and taking care of everything and just sort of issuing orders down the chain of command?
Yeah, there is. I mean, I think there are a couple of reasons. Jobs was fairly open with the press until around 1987. When he was starting Next, he did a couple of things. He did an article in GQ, I think, with Joe Nocera, and he did a PBS documentary on the entrepreneurs. Those were sort of the last time he let the press into what private life he had at that point. He was an incredibly hard worker all his life. After that, he decided that he would only do press when he had a product to introduce. And as part of that, he also decided that he was going to be the sole voice of the companies he was involved in. He thought it was easier for the public to associate one person with the company. And he also didn't want his executives to be distracted by the press or to compete for the press attention. It was a policy that grated on some of his execs. Although fundamentally, most of them didn't care that much since, you know, as they all acknowledged after he had left or after he had died or after they'd been fired, they did the best work of their lives for him. That was the great reward of working for Steve Jobs. It was an interesting policy because he fundamentally did not care what reporters thought of him, and he didn't care what most people thought of him outside of a small circle of close friends and his family and his close colleagues at work. So, you know, as a result, it did. It came to seem like, you know, Steve did everything. But what he'd learned at Pixar was, you know, to work with these close groups of talented people. And he had incredibly talented people. He had talented people at the executive level, and they were a very stable group. From 1997 to till his death, there wasn't that much turnover in that group. There was a period of transition in the mid-2000s. But other than that, you know, he had these great people working for him for long periods of time. And it was because they knew he cared about their work deeply and he respected their talents. When Ron Johnson, who created the retail stores for Apple, came to the company, he told this group of Stanford MBAs about how Steve wanted to get to know him really fast. He wanted to get to know him personally, so that he wouldn't have to worry about him anymore. He just wanted to know that Ron was going to execute the way Steve wanted him to execute. He micromanaged some of them. If you were in marketing or if you were in design, he was all over you, and he was over every detail. User interface was something that he cared about deeply, that contact point between the very point where the user goes from his own world into the computing world. If you think of a computer or your phone as a screen that lets you into an incredible world of information and games and all sorts of things, that point where you do that, that's something he was concerned about a lot. But if you were the finance manager, or if you were in operations, he didn't interfere. He just wanted to know that you were great at your job.
Because we know how the story turned out, Rick, it seems just so natural that Jobs returned to Apple in 1997. But, you know, this was a gamble on all sides. Can you talk about the things that caused Jobs to accept that with some reservations?
Well, it was a piece of brilliant opportunism and massive luck. Apple was run in 1996 by a man named Gil Amelio. He was the latest in a line of CEOs who were uninspiring and were not leading the company in any direction. And in fact, at the time, I remember when I was at Fortune, we were primarily interested in who was going to buy Apple. The question really was, who's going to buy Apple, or is it going to go out of business? And Gil Amelio needed a new operating system. And there were a couple of candidates out there who had robust operating systems that could work on a Mac platform. And one of them was B, which was run by Jean-Louis Gasset, and the other was Next. And Steve was just he was a great presenter, and he did a great job presenting his operating system to Amelio. And so they made a deal. Apple bought Next. The people at Next were not excited about this. Well, they were excited about the idea that their operating system could be used by millions of people. That's always exciting to engineers. But they thought they were going to the sick company. They thought Next was in much better shape than Apple. And they came over, and Steve was on the sidelines. He was really out of the picture. And he made a series of decisions. The first decision was that he didn't want Gil Amelio to be CEO anymore. He didn't think Amelio was successful. And he did a good job of torpedoing him with the press and with the board of directors. But then he had to decide if he really wanted to come back and be CEO himself. And, you know, his wife told us, you know, he was really, really on the fence. And the people who had moved from Next to Apple said they think he had, you know, he really didn't know what he wanted to do. He was worried about his reputation. He didn't need the money. By this time, Pixar had gone public, so he was really rich. He had young kids. But his wife wanted him to go back. She knew he was always a better man when he was had something fully engaging to dive into. And he gradually came to realize that he really wanted to try to save this company, and he felt that he was the best person for the job.
Let's take a minute here to listen to Steve Jobs narrating Apple's TV ad, "Here's to the Crazy Ones." This was 1997, and it was part of the Think Different campaign.
Here's to the crazy ones, the misfits, the rebels, the troublemakers, the round pegs in the square holes, the ones who see things differently. They're not fond of rules, and they have no respect for the status quo. You can quote them, disagree with them, glorify or vilify them. About the only thing you can't do is ignore them, because they change things. They push the human race forward. While some may see them as the crazy ones, we see genius. Because the people who are crazy enough to think they can change the world are the ones who do.
Rick Tetzeli, you hear that ad and you think, sure, it's inspiring to people who might buy an Apple product, but it's really inspiring to people who make Apple products.
Yeah, and that was what he was trying to do. It was his first move when he came back to Apple, and a real sign that something was different about him, because he knew they needed a great product. They needed to create an attention getting product quickly. But he knew that this company was, the people who worked at the company were totally disenchanted, beaten down. A third of the workforce was fired over the course of 18 months. They needed to believe in something. And so he called Lee Clow up, who was the advertising guy who had helped him with the 1984 ad, which is so famous. And he got him to work on this Think Different campaign along with some other folks. And it was more directed at the employees of Apple than it was at the outside world. He wanted to tell the outside world, hey, you should expect something great from us. But that message in 1997 had no currency. It was, Apple had said that for years and years. It had been trading on its image as, you know, this innovative, ballsy company for years. But it hadn't delivered anything. So he knew that that would continue to be the case. But inside the company, he wanted people to start thinking different.
What qualities did Jobs look for in the people who worked directly below him?
Well, one of the main things was that they talked back to him. Nobody succeeded working for Jobs, who was a wallflower. Everybody talked back. It was John Rubenstein, describes having a John says he grew up in a family like the one under the roller coaster in Annie Hall. And he says that's what it was like with Steve. It was just nonstop going back and forth, yelling at each other, his wife in the background and Laureen Jobs in the background on the other side saying, come on, we got to go. It's Christmas. They talked back. They had ideas. They were creative leaders, and they were deeply talented. You know, in Silicon Valley, it's always, they always talk about the meritocracy or that talent wins out over everything. In the case of Apple's executive team, there was character and backbone. In every single one of those key employees.
What sort of relationship did Jobs have with Tim Cook that would ultimately make Cook the natural choice to succeed him at Apple?
You know, Cook came in 1998 from Compaq Computer, where he had been called the Attila the Hun of inventory. And Apple had horrible inventory problems because it had a lot of products that nobody had been buying. And he took care of that problem very quickly. And then when Apple moved from a manufacturer of thousands of computers a month to a maker of millions of devices a month, when the iPod came along and then the iPhone, Cook oversaw all of this. He is the person who sort of made it all work. And that's another underappreciated part of the Apple story, is the execution, of the manufacturing execution behind the brilliant products is really extraordinary. They just became a global manufacturer, in a very, very short space of time. So what Cook showed Jobs was that he was incredibly capable at handling complex systems and getting people to do that. And that's why he was the perfect successor to Jobs, because the company was getting more and more complicated.
We're speaking this hour with Rick Tetzeli. He is executive editor at Fast Company magazine and co-author, along with Brent Schlender, of Becoming Steve Jobs, The Evolution of a Reckless Upstart into a Visionary Leader. If you'd like to join us, you can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the new SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program for Dallas community leaders and professionals. Now accepting applications for fall. More at smu.edu/DLS.
When I was 17, I read a quote that went something like, "If you live each day as if it was your last, someday you'll most certainly be right." It made an impression on me, and since then, for the past 33 years, I have looked in the mirror every morning and asked myself, if today were the last day of my life, would I want to do what I am about to do today? And whenever the answer has been no for too many days in a row, I know I need to change something. Remembering that I'll be dead soon is the most important tool I've ever encountered to help me make the big choices in life. Because almost everything, all external expectations, all pride, all fear of embarrassment or failure, these things just fall away in the face of death, leaving only what is truly important. Remembering that you are going to die is the best way I know to avoid the trap of thinking you have something to lose. You are already naked. There is no reason not to follow your heart.
That was Steve Jobs giving a commencement address at Stanford in 2005, 7 years before he died. We're speaking this hour with Fast Company magazine's executive editor, Rick Tetzeli, who is co-author of a new book called Becoming Steve Jobs, The Evolution of a Reckless Upstart into a Visionary Leader. Rick, to what extent was Jobs' sense of his own mortality, his two battles with cancer, one of which ultimately would claim his life, to what extent did that affect the way he approached work and also personal relationships?
I think, the two different things. I mean, at work, we talked to Johnny Ive and to Tim Cook and a couple other people about this. They felt that the impact of his cancer at work was really to slightly speed up the treadmill that Apple was on, a slightly greater sense of urgency. But Jobs was such a focused leader at Apple that the change was not that profound. His cancer at times was a major, you know, disruption for the company in 2004 when he took a leave, in 2009 when he needed a liver transplant, and of course in 2011 he was in the office very little in the months before he died. But in terms of how it changed his approach to work, it just made him a bit more focused than he already was, and he was a very, very focused person. In terms of his personal life, I think that the one thing friends have noted is that Steve himself was very helpful with other people when they got sick with cancer. There were several cases where an Apple employee or a Pixar employee or a friend of his got cancer or had a friend who got cancer, and Jobs would create these spreadsheets showing the kind of treatments available, the kind of doctors that were available, how they were rated. He would make perhaps a recommendation, you know. So he did that. That thing about living every day as if it could be your last, that just got heightened during those last years.
You tell a really poignant story here about the time that Jobs needed a liver transplant. Tim Cook approached him.
Yeah. So in 2009, Jobs needed a liver transplant. He was on the list in several states. To get on those lists, you have to prove that you're in good enough health that a transplant would in fact take and save your life. You also have to be able to get there within 8 hours. And since Steve had a private jet, he could do that. But, you know, none of these lists were – he wasn't moving ahead on any of these lists. And he was in very bad shape, and the executives of Apple used to visit him at home and brief him. And after one visit, Cook went and left the Bay Area, went somewhere where he wasn't recognized, and went through a battery of tests to ascertain whether he could be a donor for Steve. It's called a living transplant. You can donate a piece of your liver to somebody, and it'll regenerate. What you have left will regenerate for you, and what you give to the give to the person will regenerate, and it can save their lives. So he came over to Steve's house, and he started to explain this to him, and that he thought he would be a good donor for Steve, and he'd like to do that. And Steve sat up and said, "No way, I'm not going to do this. I'm not putting you in any kind of risk at all." And Cook told us this. There were about four people in the world who knew this story, four or five people who knew this story when Cook told us, and he told it to us because he thought it showed somebody who was extremely unselfish. He said to us that somebody who thinks about things only on a transactional basis does not respond in that way. And I think it's a very poignant episode, and it's also an interesting one. You know, there's things with Jobs often come down to, you know, one side's soft on Jobs, one side's hard on Jobs. He was a jerk, he wasn't a jerk, you know, which is it's a remarkably simplistic debate about the most important businessman of our times. and this too is a complex moment, because maybe in the back of his mind, Jobs also knew that he didn't have much time left. He was going to die in 2-3 years, and this was the man he knew was going to succeed him. So maybe that was going through his mind as well. I don't know. But that's the thing, is he's a very complex guy, and that's why it's so interesting to sort of explore him and write about him.
I'll never forget this moment. I don't know why I'll never forget it, but years ago, I had just gotten like an iPod, which I loved, and it was so high tech, and you could put all your CDs, I'm dating myself, into this little device that you carried with you. And I went for a walk at the lake, and I had left my kids home with a babysitter, so I had my phone with me as well. And I was thinking, what a pain that I have to have these two devices that at the time were both, you know, fairly large compared to what we have today. And you know, little did I know that someone, you know, Steve Jobs had already figured that this was, you know, a perfect synthesis. How was it that he was so good at figuring out what we would want and how to, you know, decide sort of which devices to combine into the magical thing that became the iPhone?
Well, this really was his genius. This is something that so fundamentally separates him from so many people, is, you know, the synthesis of everything that's out there into a device that answers needs we didn't know we had. It's spectacular. And it is what it's what technology is at its heart. You know, technology always is the synthesis of what exists into something new. That's how we advance. That's how the economy advances. And Jobs had this advantage from the beginning of coming to computing from the outside. He was a liberal arts guy, you know, more or as much as he was an engineering guy. And that stuck through his whole life. And he had the kind of peripheral vision that nobody in the, you know, nobody in the technology business has. And that's what he could do. He listened. There were so many inputs that he paid attention to. And out of that would come something new. And the process of, you know, his wife described him as a learning machine. And it's a very accurate way of thinking about him, because so much stuff was coming in. And then he'd put it to test. He'd put it to test. He'd put it to test. And he'd do so aggressively. So he always sounded like he was totally confident in his opinion, and, you know, if you thought, you know, any other way, you were an idiot. And then he'd change his mind 3 days later and come around to your position without acknowledging, of course, that it had been your position. But this is what he did. He reserved the right to change his mind until the last minute. This was genius, and that is why once personal computing became a thing again, thanks to Apple and thanks to the fact that Microsoft had sort of exhausted the possibilities of business computing, he could do it again and again. And incrementally, they just made gain after gain. And sometimes it resulted in breakthrough products like the iPhone, and sometimes it just resulted in better versions of what was already out there.
How much did Steve Jobs care about the accumulation of wealth?
Well, I think he cared about it. He, during the day of Pixar's IPO, Ed Catmull glanced over, and Steve had gone into another room, and he was sitting there on the couch, and he called his friend Larry Ellison, and he said, "Larry, I made it," meaning he'd made it into the billionaires club. I think he cared about it that way. He cared about it as a marker of success. You know, numbers matter at a certain point in sort of determining how successful you've been, whether it's the dollars you've accumulated or whether it's the number of units you've sold. Eddie Q describes being in an airport lounge or in the mid-2000s and looking around at all the Apple devices around him and thinking, holy cow, we've really accomplished something. Who knew? Jobs wanted to put his wealth to the side when it came to raising his kids. They lived in a very nice house in Palo Alto, but it was right on the street. He tried to give his kids as much of a middle class, upper middle class lifestyle as you can when you're a billionaire. But, you know, I think it was complicated for him, too. You know, as we know, he didn't give away much of his money during his lifetime. During the last years of his life, he built an incredibly lavish and beautiful yacht. So money mattered, but not in a profound way.
Do you think he was happy with who he had become by the time he died?
Oh, that's a great question. I think he believed deeply in what he was doing, in the rightness of what he was doing. That often resulted in his having blinders on to certain, you know, behaviors that were outlandish, like the labor collusion that he was involved in. But yes, I think he was happy with who he had become. He had found a family life that meant an enormous amount to him, and he had achieved so much. But he was not a man to look back and take stock of his own success. He really, really always wanted to look forward. That's why we called it becoming Steve Jobs, because it was always becoming something. He was always moving ahead.
Rick Tetzeli is executive editor of Fast Company magazine and co-author, along with Brent Schlender, of Becoming Steve Jobs, The Evolution of a Reckless Upstart into a Visionary Leader. Rick, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thank you so much for making this time for us.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. If you want to find me on Twitter, I'm at Chris Boyd Think. You can send email to the show at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.